Didn't finish one of the illustrations, I realized. I was telling you that I was sitting on that airplane when I came up with, or when I told this man about the four economic scenarios and the four biblical principles. And he seemed to be fascinated by those. So we talked at some length about him. He really questioned me. And I made the comment that I didn't think anybody in Washington or any place else in the country knew what was going on. And furthermore, if they did know what was going on, they had no control over it. So as we got up to, just before we landed, I asked him what he was going to Charlotte for, and he said that he was going to be speaking at a political deal. This was in the fall, and I thought, now if he's speaking at a political deal, this was in the fall of the last presidential election. I said, are you a congressman? And he said, yes, he was. And so I didn't ask him who he was. We got up and he introduced himself, and he said, my name's Jim Wright. Now, if you know who Jim Wright is, that's right. He has been on the House Banking Committee, the House Ways and Means Committee. If anybody knows anything about our economic situation, it would be Congressman Wright. So I told him my name. It didn't impress him, so as we got, that's right, I said, I'm Winston Parker. But we got in the terminal, and I said, well, I said, I want to apologize if I was presumptuous in saying that nobody knew what was going on in Washington. And he said, no, he said, frankly, he said, I don't think anybody does have control over it. That nobody can control the, there's too many dynamics and too many cards that could fall. And he said, I think that the principles that you were talking about are certainly applicable. And he said, I wish all young people could hear them. So I believe that God put that man next to me at that point in time, because sometimes you wonder in terms of what you're saying, does it have any relevance? And does it really apply? And it gave me a boldness and a confidence to communicate what I felt like God had been revealing to my heart that I would not have experienced had he not done that for me. So that was just a little... I've seen him on TV a couple times, and I hope he's forgotten my name. Now, let me tell you what I think is the problem. We know now what stewardship is, and the title of this session is How Much is Enough? And that can be answered many, many ways, but I believe that the problem is depicted by this cartoon. This is a picture of my mother who has saved millions buying things she didn't need. And she always would say it was on sale and look at the money I saved. And somehow that just never computed with me as to what she was really saying. But we are a nation of responders. And that's our problem. I'm reminded of the story about the man who came from the North Hills of Georgia to Atlanta to learn how to drive one of these big semis, an 18-wheeler. And as he was going through the school, they advised him that at the conclusion of the school, he had to take an oral examination. So after the 3 weeks training, he sat down for his oral examination. There was a panel of examiners, and they said, we're going to present you with a situation, and you need to tell us how you would respond to that situation. So he said, okay, he was ready, and they described the situation to him. They said, you're driving an 18-wheeler down a mountain, kind of like this road right out here, and there's a 600-foot drop straight to the left and no guardrail, and to your right is a 600-foot cliff going straight up. In front of you is another 18-wheeler who's going too slow, so you pull out to pass him, and as you pass him, you notice coming up the road on your side of the road is another 18-wheeler. At that time, a car pulls out to pass him, and so you put on your brakes, and your brakes fail. Now, what would you do? He thought about it for just a second. He said, well, I guess I'd wake up Leroy. And I thought, that's a strange answer. Wake up Leroy? Who's Leroy? Well, Leroy, he's my relief driver. So, well, what good would it do you wake up your relief driver in a situation like this? And he said, well, it wouldn't do me any good, but you see, Leroy's from a little town in Kentucky, and he ain't never seen a wreck like this one's going to be. And I suspect that that's the way that a lot of us handle our finances. We ain't never seen a wreck like that one's going to be. Now, what I want to do is I want to play a game. I need some help, if I could. Somebody, do not look at these. Turn them face down when you get them. And put them face down in front of you until I tell you to turn them over. No cheating. An important point while those are being passed out relates back to the last session. Somebody said, how do you know God's will? You know, that's a great question. A lot of men throughout the centuries have wanted to know, how do you know God's will? And so when we're talking about managing money, we're saying, unless you heard the messages last night and what they communicated, then you can't be a steward. In other words, there's a beginning point. And the beginning point is, who is God? And who am I relative to God? And what does that relationship mean? It's no different than any other aspect of the of your life. There is no formula for stewardship. And that's an important thing to know. There is no formula for stewardship. It would be a lot easier if God said, okay, you'll take 23.5% for tithe, 18.5% for living expenses, and thou shalt not have no debt. He didn't even say don't have debt. He just said that you're a fool if you do. That's right. But he didn't say don't, and he didn't say that it was a sin. Okay, everybody have them. Now, what we're going to do, when I tell you to turn them over, then don't yet, but when I tell you to turn them over, you're going to see something that will look like this. And what I want you to do is I'm going to give you 15 seconds. There's 100 numbers on here, from 1 to 100. And what I want you to do is to start at number 1, circle it, and then in sequence, circle number 2, 3, 4, 5, and so forth, until you get to 100. When you get to 100, raise your hand. And I'm going to give you... Oh, yeah. There's 100 on there. And when I say go, then take 15 seconds and go as far as you can in 15 seconds. You ready? Go. What a group of competitors. Yeah. Actually, I gave you 16 seconds, so I cheated a bit. How many, who thinks they did pretty well on this? How many have played the game before? Has anybody? Here's one, two. How'd you do?
Six?
10? Okay, anybody do better than 10? Nobody did better than 10. Anybody do 9? Here's one 9. One armed guy that did not, that didn't, had never played the game. How about 8? Several did 8? 7? Few? 6? Now we're getting down to the bell curve. 5? There we go. 4? 3? There we go. That's the majority. What a retarded group. I'm going to go back and give that last lecture over. 2? Who got 1? Everybody got 1, of course, because it was circled. How did you feel when you were going through here? I know how you looked. Furious? Harassed? Frustrated? Any other feelings? Pressure? A lot of competitiveness. Saw some... Disorganized? Lack of... Well, it probably would have been easier if I'd have told you that if you divide this down this way into quadrants, you would always find the 1 in this quadrant, the 2 in this quadrant, the 3 down here, and the 4 over here, and then we start over. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. How many think you could have done better? Yeah, everybody could have done better, and everybody does do better, typically. The one that did the most had done it one other time. Did you remember the secret? Okay. The problem with our financial life is that there are far more alternatives to spend money than what there is money available. That's the basic problem. And as a consequence, we live our life as responders. I was in Bunker Hunt's office one time and was talking to him. And just before that, a Fortune magazine article had come out about the Hunt family, and they said that the Hunt family was worth $8 billion. And I had computed that that meant something like $3 million of tax-free income a day for that family. Most people could live on that. And I thought to myself, I wonder if God knows how much money this guy has. You know, that's a lot of money. $3 million a day at tax-free. $8 billion. The only way I could get my hands around it was to make it equivalent to a daily income. And then I came out of his office, and I thought, I wonder how much downtown Dallas $8 billion would buy. I don't know that it would buy all of downtown Dallas. I doubt it. Certainly wouldn't buy the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Wouldn't buy the state of Texas. Wouldn't buy the United States. Wouldn't buy the world. And he's one of the world's wealthiest men. $8 billion. And how much is that to God? It's nothing. It's a pittance. And you know he has the same problem that you and I have. There are more alternatives to spend money than money available. Always will be. I don't care how much money you have. There will always be more alternatives to spend it than you'll have money available. That's a given. It's a truth. So piling up more will not satisfy the financial planning problem at all. In fact, it'll frustrate it. Because the more that you have, the more alternatives that you have. And if you talk to anybody that's got wealth, a lot of wealth, you find that that is their biggest problem, is that they have so many alternatives now with a lot of wealth that it's a very frustrating and confusing situation. Planning, I'm going to give you a definition, is the allocation of limited resources among various unlimited alternatives. And that's all that planning is. So it's taking limited resources and allocating them, predetermining where they're going to be used among various unlimited alternatives. Financial planning, that's what it is. If I said you had an income of whatever it may be, how many alternatives do you have to spend that money? You'd say, well, they're unlimited, and they are. But they can be boiled down to five alternatives. There are only five things that you can do with money, and everything will fit into one of those five. What do you think they are? There are only five things you can do with money. Give it away. That's one. Spend it is one. Keep it is another. Accumulate it. So I give it away, I can accumulate it, or I can spend it. What else can I do with it? Invest is keep. Waste, that's negative keeping. Okay, negative investing. Pay debt, that's four. One more. Taxes. Yeah. Taxes. That's funny. It's always the last one mentioned. Okay. Five things that I can do with money. I can spend it. I can give it away. I can pay taxes. I can pay off debt. Or I can use it to accumulate. If I want to put it into a diagram, it looks this way. And walk with me through the diagram. This diagram is going to attempt to put some order into your financial planning. We can. Sure, we can get a copy of it. Okay? Yeah, well, that'd be better. Why don't you just listen and see if I have anything worth saying. And let me walk you through this diagram. Because to me, this is financial planning all wrapped up into one place. Long range, short range, every aspect of it. In the short term, I have the five uses of money. Giving it away, paying taxes, spending it, paying off debt, or accumulating it. As I accumulate it, I also invest it. It's investment planning, and my accumulation plus my appreciation grows my net worth. The question is, why do I grow my net worth? And in the long range, there's only six things you can do with money. Become financially independent, send your kids to college, pay off debt, improve your lifestyle, give it away, or start your own business. And if you think about it, long range, those are the only six alternatives that you have. In short range, you have five alternatives. So now, right away, we can see that if I know what my goals are in these 11 areas, in terms of I want to spend so much, I want to be financially independent, I want to send my kids to college, I want to give so much. If I know what those goals are, then right away I have developed a game plan to get there. This integrates the whole issue of investment planning. Where does insurance fit in this? Does it? Give it away. I didn't say that. All the insurance agents on this side of the room and all the rest of you over here. Now, insurance fits right here. I look at it, and I don't work for Travelers, but I look at it as an umbrella. It's the protection. Until I can achieve, ultimately the objective is to be self-insured. Now, there are other reasons to have insurance, of course, but until I reach the point of self-insurance, I at least need insurance to provide for the long-term objectives. One of the biggest problems that I see is people don't have enough insurance. Part of the reason that they don't is that they don't know where they're going. They don't have any idea. Pardon? You cannot use this tape to sell insurance without giving me a kickback. So I have investment planning. I have tax planning. I have giving planning. I have my insurance planning, and down here I have my life or my estate planning, because ultimately I'm going to die, and I'm going to have to distribute it sometime, some way. The process of financial planning is, first of all, to figure out where I am, summarize my present situation, and that is, what am I spending, and what do I have in the way of net worth, and what do I have in the way of insurance, and what do I have in the way of an estate plan? So if I can summarize my present situation, number two, establish my long-range financial goals. Now I know where I am, God's resources. I know where I'm going, God's goals. And that's how I establish them, by spending time with Him. And ultimately, there's only one way to accomplish your goals. Guess what that is? Spend less than you earn, and do it for a long time. That's the guaranteed key to financial success. If you spend less than you earn, you do it for a long time, you will be financially successful. There is no other way other than an inheritance or striking oil. So I have to increase my cash flow margin. In other words, I plan to have an excess every year. And then lastly, once I have a plan in place, how do I control it? This is where your budget planning comes in and your cash flow control system that you may have. Now, several observations on this diagram. First of all, how I allocate in the short term or in the long term among all of these alternatives is a function of three things. First of all, the commitments that I already have. These are not necessarily in priority order. But if I have certain commitments, in other words, I have five children and one wife, so I have a certain lifestyle minimum just in order to provide for my family. That's a commitment. If I had any debt, that's a commitment. Perhaps I've made giving commitments. Perhaps I have a tax commitment. In fact, I do have a tax commitment. Okay, so how I allocate is a function of my commitments. Maybe I'm in a pension plan. That's a commitment for financial independence, towards financial independence. Secondly, it's a function of my goals. So how I allocate is dependent upon the goals I have. People are going to have different goals. That's what makes you unique, your commitments and the goals that you have. And then thirdly, and this is what really distinguishes people, is their priorities. Some may place a high priority on paying taxes. Haven't met anybody yet like that, but they could. Some have a high priority to get out of debt. Some have a high priority to give, to spend, to accumulate, for these reasons down here. So how I allocate among these five alternatives is a function of my commitments, my goals, and my priorities. Secondly, there is a trade-off between the short term and the long term. If I use it in the short term, it's not available for the long term. If I use it for the long term, it's not available in the short term. And there are three financial planning principles that you may want to take down. Number one, sure, Gail. You can ask questions as we go along.
Okay. All right. I don't have a train of thought. Whatever moves me, Gail, I just go with the flow. Okay, there are three financial planning principles. Number one, there are no independent financial decisions. Okay, that's an important thing to keep in mind. If I make a decision in the giving area, it has automatically impacted every one of these other 10 areas. Because I have said, I no longer have the money for those 10. If I make a commitment to start my own business and put money away for that, it has taken money out of the other 10. So there are no independent financial decisions. The biggest financial decision-making mistake that I see is the binary trap. It is, should I do this or not? Should I buy that new car or not? Should I do this investment or not? Should I buy that insurance policy or not? The problem with that is you only have two alternatives. And your decision can never be any better than your best alternative. So when you get yourself into a binary trap, you have missed the real question. And the real question is, what's the best use of those funds? And so anytime somebody presents you, for example, with an investment alternative, it'll always come to you looking like this. Let me show you a good deal. Well, you're dumb to pass up a good deal. Think about that. There is no investment that has ever been presented to you or me that, let me show you a bad deal. Okay, so if you start out, let me show you a good deal, you're dumb if you pass it up. I mean, by definition, you're dumb if it's really a good deal. Now, the way to get out of the trap of responding to that is to say, what's the best use of my money? Because there are no independent financial decisions. And if when I'm presented with that spending alternative, I say, is this the best use of the money? And think through my alternatives, it's going to explode the alternatives and allow me to make a better financial decision. We see ourselves, spend a lot of time in the whole counseling area and getting people out of the binary trap. Incidentally, good deals only go bad. Not every deal is a good deal, it just goes bad. No banker ever makes a bad loan. They just go bad. Nobody ever invests in a bad deal in terms of an investment. It just goes bad. And I guarantee you something, there's another good deal tomorrow, another one tomorrow, another one tomorrow. I was so happy when I turned 40 because I finally felt like I had some experience. And one of the things that I learned over the last 20 years in the area of finances is there's always another good deal. Always. And if you have to make a decision, it's easy, don't. Because just wait for tomorrow and there'll be another one. So number one, there's no such thing as an independent financial decision. Number two, the longer range the perspective, the better the financial decision today. The longer range the perspective, the better the financial decision today. That's similar to the, in fact, a friend of mine coined the definition for financial maturity. Financial maturity is giving up today's desires for future benefits. What did Walt say last night? Self-denial. Why? For a future benefit, which is what? Heavenly reward. Self-denial. The longer range the perspective, the better the financial decision today. In fact, the longer range the perspective, the better the decision today. And so I would not deny myself without an eternal perspective. Why would anybody give money away? Absolutely foolishness to give money away from the temporal perspective. There is no benefit other than ego benefit from giving money away. The only reason that you would do it is because of the eternal perspective. The longer range the perspective, the better the decision today. And only Christians have available to them the eternal perspective. So when making your decision, if we bring it back and we have an opportunity to do something, we need to ask ourselves, where am I going? And if I know where I'm going, I'm apt to make a better decision today because it'll impact the long term. There is a trade-off between the short term and the long term. And we live in a have it now society. I want it now. I asked one of my daughters one time how her friends would define success, and it was a great definition. I want what I want when I want it. And if I can have what I want when I want it, then I am successful. And that's exactly what we're living in terms of society. And there is hundreds of billions of dollars being spent to convince you that you have a right to it. Right now. Hundreds of billions of dollars, and you, apart from the Holy Spirit and me, cannot withstand that advertising. And advertisers would say, spend it today, rather than take a long-term perspective. So what we're talking about here, remember one of our to-be's? To be different. To be salt and light. A Christian has a long-term perspective, and he lives his life in a whole different context than the non-Christian. He is understanding the eternal and is willing to give up today. The third implication is financial decisions today have lifetime implications. I would say it this way. Decisions determine destiny. If it's spent, it's gone. And therefore, you have determined your destiny. And I'm going to put some real meat on that at this point. But before I get into that, maybe this would be a good point to ask for any questions, if you have any, over what we've gone over so far. Lifestyle desires? Uh-huh. Financial maturity. Right. Giving up today's desires for future benefits. Delayed gratification. Yes, it does. You have a right to it. You only go around once. Get all the gusto you can. It's exactly right. There was an article in Reader's Digest a couple months ago about just that very issue, is that to take a long-term perspective is foolishness. Enjoy it now. That's the only thing that matters. We're a hedonistic society. Gail? Great question. Well, we're going to talk about it a little bit, but let me give it to you and my own feelings on this and opinions and what I get out of it. The question was, from a Christian standpoint, let me rephrase it, Gail. Is it right for a Christian to strive for financial independence? Would that be a fair way to state it? Okay. And the word independence grates on the Christian because it seems to say independent from God. And I'm not meaning to imply that, because you'll never have enough when it comes to financial resources to provide security and to provide freedom from worry and anxiety. It is not a function of money in terms of the security. But you can accumulate enough to provide for yourself and your family in light of an uncertain economic environment. There is an amount that I can say that's enough in light of today's economy. And if I know what that is, then the question becomes, what if I've already accomplished all these long-term objectives? Why do I accumulate beyond that point? And you know, I can only think of one reason. And that is because of the striving to be independent from God. If I can pile up enough, I'll be independent from God. But you'll never have enough to do that. So what our challenge is, and we work with hundreds of clients, probably three-fourths of them have already achieved financial independence and already accomplished these objectives here. And our challenge to them is, why are you continuing to pile it up? What are you going to do with it? And I believe that God has given some Christians the ability to earn and make money, not to become financial, not to become independent of God, but to give it away. And if he's given me the ability to give it away, I have a man that I met with last week in the Atlanta airport. And this is an interesting guy. He started a company 25 years ago and committed that 90% of anything that came out of that company was going to go into the Lord's work. And he sold the company last February, a year ago,
for $50 million. He had given away 90% of his income for 25 years, and he still had $50 million left. That's enough to live off of. He gave away $45 million when he sold the company, and he's got $5 million left. And his challenge to me, he said, I'll pay you $55,000 a year in a fee, basically is what he said, in order to tell me how much is enough so I can give it away. He said, I do not want to overaccumulate. Now, there's a man with an eternal perspective. And what's it going to mean to him when he gets to heaven with the money that God has given? Incidentally, he has made. This guy can't help but make money. And he's made several million in the last year. And that's one of the problems when you get so much money that it just keeps piling up. But his challenge... I speak from the experience of counseling. Not... You like the problem? I see. Okay. That's a long answer to that question, but it really, the how much is enough issue, if I've accomplished it, you've got to ask yourself, why am I continuing to accumulate? Because, again, you'll never accumulate enough to be secure. That's not any... Our fees? Lifestyle. That's a good question. I haven't figured that one out. I don't think we have those built in. I had a man, okay. Can it wipe it out? Your own personal debt retirement. Yeah, this is the priority. I mean, your number one priority whenever you have debt is debt repayment. Before living, before taxes, and before giving, and certainly before accumulation. The banker will not lend you money without taking collateral in almost every case. So that is your number one priority. Now, people may not recognize that, but that is in fact it. And I think Proverbs handles it well. The borrower becomes the lender's slave. Exactly right. In fact, this is your number one priority. And talking now from a legal standpoint, that's number two. And now how are you going to put the rest of them in there? Giving above the tithe?
Are you talking about, is tithe number one or debt tithe?
Well, from a legal standpoint, the banker's not, if you go to him and say, look, I got to do my tithe, I'd like to pay you back. Well, he's going to say, guess again, fella. So, I'm just saying that, let's look at it this way. If I establish that as my next priority, then I have determined my lifestyle at the maximum. See that? Now, here's what happens. Most of us say, I've got $100,000 income, therefore I have $100,000 to spend. Okay. Most of us say, I have X as an income, therefore I have X to spend. And we forget these three things. Larry Burkett has a concept a lot of people have stolen, myself included. It's called the net spendable income concept. And the net spendable income concept says that as the income comes out, my number one, two, and three priorities are my tithe, tax, and debt repayment. What's left is net spendable. Where we get into the trap is we say, well, I have a certain lifestyle I have to fund. Obviously, I got to pay taxes. And because of my lifestyle, I have certain debt I've had to take on. Boy, I wish I had the money to give. And I would if it wasn't for taxes. Think about that. That is a logic of how many people that you run into. And if I could only reduce my taxes, I could give more. Or if I didn't have the debt, I could give more. I'd like to, but I just can't. Pastor, you've got to understand. I'd like to give more, but I can't. Financially, I'm strapped. When, in fact, if we started over and started right and set our priorities, then we would have set a certain lifestyle. Self-denial. The whole issue. And you will not follow what I would call a Christian lifestyle without having to experience self-denial. I don't care how much money you make.
Because the more money you make, the more that you're apt to spend. We typically, I remember when I got out of college and started working, I was always 2 years ahead of my income in terms of my spending. And consequently going into debt. I met a stockbroker not long ago who sets his family budget on his income 5 years ago in order to make sure that he's meeting the long term. That's rather drastic. This fellow's not even a Christian, but that is a little bit of what I'm saying about you're going to have to set your priorities. I would say if you've done a good job of planning, number one, I would give. I would two, I would plan to pay my taxes. Three, I would hope I wouldn't have any debt. That's the way I'd like to see it work. Yes, there's two problems with debt. Number one, getting into debt. Number two, getting out of debt. Okay? That's right. The first one's easy. It's like climbing an ice, you're coming down an ice-covered hill. Getting down, getting into debt is just like coming down that hill covered with ice. Getting out of debt is like going back up the same hill. It is very, very difficult. And the only way that you can get out of debt is you have to make two decisions. Number one, stop going into debt anymore. And number two, set up a repayment plan that's a part of your priorities. Okay, and it's a juggling, and there is no right answer. All right? Now, what's more spiritual, getting out of debt or giving? Okay, but I didn't ask that question. I said, which one is more spiritual? Okay, that's right. There are neither one are more spiritual. Now, I, by obedience, give out of the first fruits of my income, yes. And I give above and beyond that. But that is not, getting out of debt is no less spiritual. And if God has convicted you to get out of debt, and you're using your money that way, you are being obedient.
John Wesley.
No, I don't think it is too simple. I think that if you put it into this context, you're still going to have to struggle with the priorities. You know, save all you can and give all you can. Which one's more? And so in terms of making it workable, you know, one of the things about the Christian life that makes it so difficult is that it's dynamic. And there are no easy answers. And that's, I think there's a good reason for that. What did I say? God uses money in my life in the growth process, and He uses money as a tool. And as I struggle through these priorities, that's when the real gut-level issues of life come out. You know why? And it's so relevant in money is because money is the reflection of the real priorities in life. I mean the real priorities. I'm not talking about the money priorities, the real priorities. Leisure time, family commitments, business commitments, all priorities will funnel themselves out through your checkbook. Why do husbands and wives not get along with in the area of money? Because they have conflicting priorities. And when it comes to trying to work them out, you're going head-to-head in many cases. So money is dynamic because it reflects you cannot serve God and money. That's why He you gave us that dichotomy. Because that's where the priorities are worked out. Question? All the answers, I'd be strong. If I had all the answers, I would be strong. But I can't stand up here and say I have all the answers. All I'm giving you is a process to work out God's working in your life in the area of finances and relating it back to the whole context of what is a Christian. Who is God and who am I? And in the money area, we're just taking one small aspect of the Christian life and trying to fit it into the real big picture. That's what we're doing. And money happens to be a real high priority because it so reflects what's going on in my life spiritually. I believe you can look at a man's checkbook and tell when he became a Christian. Should be able to. I know you could in my checkbook because my whole priorities in life changed. My whole value system changed when I became a Christian. And if you can't see a difference, then I would question his salvation. Okay. That's kind of hard, but I'll question then. I'll get down to what I know I'm talking about. Yeah. Actually, there are three things. There's time, there's investments, and there's inheritance. If you think about it, and actually a fourth, debt. So these are the four sources of money coming in, and as it comes in, I have to allocate it. So yes, you're right in terms of a time allocation.
Well, I was looking at
Right. Not possible. I'll tell you why, because God won't allow it to be possible. That's like saying, if I can do my giving, now I've taken care of God's side, or if I can spend 20 minutes a day with each child, then I've done my part. God doesn't allow us to live that way. He always brings the interruptions in order to teach me something and to grow me up. The question is not God why, but God what. You know, what do you want me to learn? Because as I experience that frustration level, I say, God, what is it that you're trying to teach me right now? And I respond to that teaching. But I don't try to kill it by over-planning. The last few minutes of our time this morning, I wanted this is going to be a little talk called Don't Miss the Miracle. And I'll share with you this whole principle of time management in a real brief nutshell. Well, let's go on and cover a couple more points and before we take a short break. I had a man come into my office some time ago, about 3 years ago, and said, boy, I wish we'd go back to double-digit inflation. I shook my head. He said, you're kidding. What do you mean? He said, I'm serious. He said, I never made so much money as when we were having double-digit inflation. I said, well, tell me about it. He said, I have $300,000 in the money market fund, and he said, I was earning 18, 19, 20, 21% in interest at no risk and total liquidity. He said, now that inflation's coming down, he said, I'm only earning 7, 8, 9%. He said, I'd be a lot better off with inflation. And you know what? He was right. He was exactly right, and he discovered a principle that I'm going to share with you after I build the base. If I gave you, many of you are life insurance agents, and you understand the principle of compounding, which we want to talk about right now. But those of you that don't understand that, if I gave you $10,000, told you I could invest it at 25%, you never added another penny to it, in 40 years, how much would you have to retire on? Lots. $400,000? $10,000, my beginning amount, never add another penny to it. $40 years. You'd have a million? Well, the answer is $75 million. Okay. If I took $10,000, never added another penny to it, and could earn 25% in 40 years, I'd have $75 million. Actually, I'd have $231,000 extra to give away. Now, if I could only earn 24%, what would I have? 54 million. $21 million difference on one percentage point, same time period, same amount of money, one percentage point difference. That's called the magic of compounding. If we had $1,000 a year, take the 24% illustration, and I deposited $1,000 a year at 24%, in 40 years, it would grow to $28,802. Notice, $1,000 a year for 40 years is how much? $40,000. How much over here? $10,000. $54 million. So I had to put in four times as much in order to accumulate $32 million less. Four times as much, same interest rate. Four times as much in order to accumulate $32 million less. The magic of compounding has three variables to it. First of all, the time. That's unique to you. Some of you have a lot of time left. Some of you have little time left. Second is the interest rate, of course. And the third is the amount. Proverbs 13:11 in the New International says, he who gathers little by little causes it to grow. And I would like to draw three principles out of the magic of compounding and out of what we've looked at so far. Principle number one is what I call the guaranteed key to financial success that I've already told you. Somebody stopped me one time and they said, I'm going to be teaching a Sunday school lesson on stewardship. Can you tell me everything you know in 30 seconds? They said, it won't take me that long. Take me 10. Spend less than you earn and do it for a long time period. And that is the key to financial success. That is guaranteed key to financial success. If I save $1,000 a year, I save $40,000, but I end up with $22 million. Now, I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. You're saying, where do you get 25%, and what will $22 million be worth in 40 years? And you've ignored the impact of taxes. I understand that. But give me time, and I'll answer all those. The second principle, remember, that's the britches. So don't hear me all the way through. The second principle is there is an opportunity cost to consumption. And the opportunity cost is when I spend a dollar today, does it take a dollar out of the future? It takes multiple dollars out of the future. So when I overspend today, it's not costing me what I overspend. It's costing me what that could have done in the future. The opportunity cost of consumption. So if I overspend, when I go to the grocery store, and I pick up that candy bar and that magazine, and I spend $2 a day, and I do that every day, I've only overspent for a month $83. $83 in a year is $1,000. $1,000 over a working life is $40,000. What did it cost me to overspend $2 a day? $22 million if I could have earned 24%. The opportunity cost of consumption. What's the first big item that somebody buys when they get out of high school or college?
Car.
So the way they do that, they go to their savings account, take the $10,000, $12,000 out, and buy the car, right? No. It doesn't generally work that way. What do? They borrow. How much do they spend in interest? Just give me a ballpark figure. Okay, but how much on an annual basis? Say $2,000. What does it cost them to drive that car? Well, if they continue to redo that car every 3 or 4 years, like Detroit says they should, it costs them $44 million to drive that car. That's called the opportunity cost of consumption. Now, the only way to offset that is if you buy something that appreciates in value. How many cars appreciate in value? You know, there's an interesting point. I used to get calls from Texas all the time. I know there's a couple Texans in here, but Dallas is particularly bad in the Christian community because you're not a Christian in Dallas unless you drive a Mercedes. That's right. I mean, you can't be. God obviously hasn't blessed you if you're not driving. What is it? It's a Mercedes. Great. How much is it going to cost you? $45,000. But I get to write off the interest and I get investment tax credit and I hold my value on the car, so it's a great investment. And I'd say, well, how much will that thing appreciate over the next 5 years? Well, probably nothing. It'll probably just hold its own. I said, well, how often do you buy an investment that at best will hold its own? Well, not very often. Well, okay, let's take it out of the investment category then. So why do you need to have a Mercedes? Well, because I need transportation. Well, is that the best type of transportation? No, you know, I can take the bus. Well, why do you want a Mercedes? Well, I don't know. Let me tell you why. It's because it's an ego decision. And every car decision, incidentally, this is proven by studies, so I'm not being condemning here, and I have the same problem. But almost every car decision, the Wall Street Journal did an article, and they said people are now buying cars for transportation. Shake your head. Well, what in the world were they buying them for before? They were buying them to satisfy some type of ego, some type of self-worth, self-image need. So I said, look, just recognize that the buying of that Mercedes is not an economic decision. It's a bad economic decision. It might be a good purchase, but it's a bad economic decision. You're doing it for ego purposes. Say, okay, we get by that barrier. So I only have one other requirement now, and that is that you pay cash. They say, well, I can't afford that. I said, that's the point. What did that Mercedes cost them? How much does $45,000 cost in interest per year? A lot. You know, $6,000, $7,000 a year, depending on the interest rate. The opportunity cost of consumption, it was a very, very bad financial decision disguised as a good investment. And you need to be careful
in terms of spending it today, because a dollar spent today takes multiple dollars out of the future. A dollar saved today puts multiple dollars in the future. The third principle is that cost of a mistake. You know, if you make a mistake and you lose it, we've had a lot of clients invested in opal mines in Brazil because they got a 5-to-1 tax write-off. Had to be a good deal, but they made money on the deal. The only problem was the IRS came along, made them pay all of the back taxes, interest, penalties, and there was no opal mine in Brazil. What did it cost them to make that mistake? Well, it cost them what that dollar could have earned, that $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 could have earned over a long time period. So the opportunity cost of consumption, the cost of a mistake, and spend less than you earn are the three principles that come out of the magic of compounding. Now you're saying, well, what about inflation? And let me give you four myths to inflation. M-Y-T-H-S. The four myths of inflation. Number one, it will cost more later, is a myth of inflation. 4 years ago, farmland in Iowa was $3,500 to $4,000 an acre. What can you buy it for today? $1,800. Prime farmland. How many people thought that oil was going to be $100 a barrel by today? A lot of people. What is it today? 15 are talking about it going below 10. The issue of it will cost more later, and we've had inflation, incidentally, over the last 15 years. So even though we've had inflation, that's not true that everything's going to cost more later. What happens is that advertisers trick us, and they say, you better buy it today because it's going to cost more later. And what we do is we end up funding our greeds rather than our needs. That's one of the myths of inflation. It causes us, because it's going to cost more later, we end up funding our greeds instead of our needs in some cases. Second myth is you should always borrow to buy. That's a myth of inflation. OPM is the way the business schools teach it, other people's money. And they say that if you're going to do anything, always do it with somebody else's money. But it assumes two things that most people leave out. It assumes appreciation, for one thing, and it assumes a lower debt cost than that appreciation. And from the Christian standpoint, it may very well presume upon the future, which is a sin. Because here's what happens. The issue of always borrowing to buy will allow me to fund certain things that I don't need. And again, I'll come back to the farmer illustration. That's the classic problem we have going on in Iowa right now, in Indiana and Illinois and throughout the Midwest and throughout the West, is that because the price was always going to go up, you should lever up to the hilt. Always borrow to buy because the price is going to go up. That ignores the sovereignty of God. What about the investment that comes along? I've got a good friend who was the head of a Christian ministry, made about $25,000, $30,000 a year, who put $25,000 into an oil well. Why? Because it was an absolute sure thing. Where did he get the money? He took a second mortgage on his home. Because it made good sense. He was advised to do that by his accountant. Because he could write off the interest. Now, if you want to write off on interest, I'm going to give you a better write-off. If you will loan me $10,000, I will promise to never repay you. And you can write it off as a bad debt. It's a guaranteed tax deduction. Now, what's the difference between that and interest? None. Interest, when it's spent, is gone forever. Yes, there's a tax benefit to it. Does the tax benefit ever make it economical? No. It might make it more economical, but it never makes it a good deal. And in times of inflation, we have fallen into a trap of saying, I should always borrow to buy. We took a good principle, and that was, in times of inflation, with values going up, presumably, and low financing cost, if I can borrow at a low cost on an appreciating item, I'm going to pay it back with cheaper dollars, and I do get the impact of leverage. Yes, very good. But does that apply to credit card debt? Does it apply to bad investments like farmland and oil, which weren't bad when they were made? Does it apply to cars? No. And we've taken a general principle, or a good principle, and we've generalized it and made it a very bad principle because of inflation. Thirdly, the issue of you can never accumulate enough is a myth. Some of you were asking in your minds. He said britches. Because $75 million isn't going to be worth much in 40 years. How many of you thought that? Truthfully? Nobody? Okay. Well, untruthfully, how many of you thought it? $75 million. What will $75 million be worth in 40 years? Okay, depends on the inflation rate. First of all, can you get 25% on investments today? Pardon? None that you invest in? None that you would invest in. Well, in terms of having money in a money market fund, obviously you can't get 25%. But there are certain investments that have done very, very well over the last 15 years. Merrill Lynch did a study. They called it the Revenge of the Nerds. Great study. Because what it said was that people that had left their money in money market type instruments over the last 15 years were the number one winner. It wasn't oil. It wasn't collectibles. It wasn't land. It wasn't anything to do with what you would normally think of, because those things went like this. And they ended up, over the 15-year time period, near the bottom. But those that had left their money accumulated in money market-type instruments always, listen to this, always beat inflation. Why? There is something called a real interest rate. The Swiss have done a study that shows that the real interest rate is always, well, historically, over the last 700 years, is 3%. So anybody that is lending money will never lend it at less than a spread of 3% than the inflation rate and what they're going to earn back. There's a real interest rate. Now, if I am a lender of money and somebody that deposits money in a money market fund or in the bank even, what are you? You're a lender of money. You're allowing somebody else to use your money. If you buy a treasury bill, you're a lender of money. If I am a lender of money, how am I going to do in time of inflation? Great. That's what that man was saying. He said, I've never made so much money as when we had inflation. And if you're a lender of money, I don't know what the inflation rate's going to be. I don't know what your earnings rate's going to be, but I can tell you this. Over time, you will always beat inflation. So it didn't make any difference whether we have inflation or not. It may not be 25%. If we have inflation, you won't have 75 million. You may have 2 trillion. And that's the point. We've been trapped into saying that if I borrow, I'm going to beat inflation, when just the opposite is true. And God said that in His Word. If I lend, I'm going to beat inflation. How many Jewish people do you know that are borrowers? Not very many. Jewish people tend to be lenders, and they have preserved their wealth through centuries by following 3 principles. Keep it portable, keep it diversified, and keep it liquid. That's right. And we need to learn from that, because they follow the Old Testament way of doing things financially. And if I can get myself on the lending side of inflation as opposed to the borrowing side of inflation, I'll always come out ahead. And yet the world tells us, no, in time of inflation, lever up. And the Bible says, don't lever up. Get just the opposite. In time of inflation, get out of debt and be a lender of money. Now, the fourth myth of inflation is that there is a standard rate of inflation for everyone. In other words, when you read the paper and it says the CPI is 3%, is that your inflation rate? No. You have a different inflation rate. The CPI assumes that everybody buys a new home every month. And not many people I know do that. So, your inflation rate may be dramatically different than what's reported in the paper. Therefore, that real interest rate is greater than the 3% that I talked about. As a matter of fact, we've done a study over the last 35 years, and even in our society, money invested in government T-bills, government investments, beat the inflation rate every year by at least 3%. So you need to be a net lender rather than a net borrower. That's why the Bible says he who borrows is a fool. The borrower becomes the lender's slave. I think it'd be time for us to take a break for about 5 minutes, maybe a stand-up break, and then I'll answer a couple questions, and we'll finish up. Talked about compounding, and somebody asked me a good question. They said, am I advocating being a lender of money? And I use the word lender in terms of saver, really. You know, before you lend money to a friend, decide what you need worse, the money or the friend. I am not advocating lending money to individuals. I am saying that in terms of lending, if you are spending less than you earn, you in effect are investing it someplace. That's what I'm calling lending. And you're better off to be accumulating by spending less than you earn than by trying to borrow your way to financial freedom. That's really the dichotomy that I'm drawing. Debt, and I want to cover debt right now in terms of a biblical perspective. Debt does two things. I call this the danger of debt. Number one, debt always presumes upon the future. Right? Sure it does. Because if you borrow money, you are saying, I will pay it back in the future. So debt always presumes upon the future. In James 4, verses 13 to 17, says, don't do that. Don't presume upon the future. How do you know what tomorrow is going to bring forth? And debt will always presume upon the future. The reason it presumes upon the future as a Christian, Psalm 37:21 says, the wicked man borrows and does not pay back. Psalm 37, verse 21, the wicked man borrows and does not pay back. So it is unscriptural for a Christian to not pay back debt. Therefore, I don't care whether you're in a corporation or in a tax shelter or whatever, if you borrow money, you are obligating yourself as a believer to pay it back. Question? Is bankruptcy wrong as a Christian? The non-repayment of debt is wrong as a Christian. That's what I'm saying. It may be that you would avail yourself of bankruptcy laws to give you some time, but to escape the repayment of debt through bankruptcy, I think, is wrong for the Christian. There's a man who wrote a book called God Save My Business, or Save from Bankruptcy. Walt Maloon wrote the book. He's the manufacturer of Correct Craft Boats, which is a ski boat. And he declared bankruptcy in his corporation, but just about 2 years ago, this has been probably 15 years ago, just about 2 years ago, he paid back the last debt. So that it is wrong for the Christian to not pay back debt. Now, if it's wrong for the Christian to not pay back debt, what do you think God's going to do? What's Jesus going to do when he comes back for the rapture? Is he going to take in the rapture those Christians who still owe money? You know, the rapture may have occurred. I always get a few nervous laughs when I say that. Question. 21. And you know, frankly, men, a lot of us get into debt without understanding the fact we're going to have to pay it back. I mean, we've not really asked ourselves the question, what happens if I lose my job? Or what happens if this investment doesn't turn out? If we ask those two questions, we then would probably avoid a lot of the mistakes that we mentioned. Debt really allows us to fund our greeds in many, 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 many cases. The second principle, or second danger of debt, is that debt may, I'm not saying always, but may deny God an opportunity to work. Remember the illustration of borrowing $100,000 the line of credit, I am convinced to this day that had I kept that line of credit, I never would have seen that Coca-Cola contract. I think God was saying, you can choose your ways or you can choose my ways. Now, how do you think it makes me feel in terms of a ministry to have seen that $10,000 provided? Does it give me some feelings of authority and credibility? I don't have any question about who it is that has me in this particular ministry. And I believe that had I used the world's way to do it, I would have denied God an opportunity to work, and I never would have seen the miracle. And the title of this last talk is Don't Miss the Miracle. And one of the ways that we can miss the miracle is by denying God an opportunity to work through our logic, through our practicality. It seems to make sense. So those are the two dangers of debt. Here are some scripture references regarding debt. Debt is not a sin, as I've said. No place in the Bible does it say debt is a sin. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8 says that a man is worse than an infidel if he does not take care of his family. And debt may deny the ability to take care of your family. So you can get yourself into a sin situation through the use of debt. Luke 14, verse 28 said, what man would build a tower without counting the cost? Count the cost to debt. If you can't pay it back, what happens to your testimony in an unsaved world? It's lost. We have a lot of men in Atlanta that Gail knows and David knows that followed the greater fool theory in 74 and 75. And that was, if I buy this piece of property, there's always a bigger fool than I am that will pay more for it than I will, than I did. Now, that was fine until the prices went like this. And those fools that still had the land were the ones that lost everything. And they lost their testimony. Many, many Christians lost their testimony and their families through the use of debt. Debt or financial problems is the greatest cause of physical violence in marriages. Over 60% of the violence in marriages is caused by financial problems. And debt's one of their leading reasons for that. Luke 12, verse 15. Let me read that. Luke 12, verse 15 says this, and he told him this parable. Oops. Jesus replied, man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you? Then he said, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. This is really important. Debt is never the problem. It's only the symptom. If you're in a debt problem, it's only symptomatic of something else. It is not the problem. And you have to ask yourself, why am I in that particular problem? Typically, it'll come back to two things, self-indulgence and greed, both of which are sins. Debt's not the problem. Debt's not the sin. Self-indulgence and greed are the sin. So when you see someone or you find yourself in that situation, don't throw up your hands and quit. Deal with the root problem and go on. All of us have made mistakes. In fact, you wouldn't be a Christian if you didn't realize and admit the fact that you've been a failure in the terms of providing your own salvation. You can't do it. So all you want to do is you have to want to say, God, what are you telling me? Not God, why do you have me in this debt problem? But God, what are you trying to tell me by keeping the pressure on? It's always a symptom. Romans 13, verse 8 says, owe no man anything. Now that verse is not talking about debt. It's talking about love. The whole context of that is love. But there's a principle that you can pull out of there, and if you owe no man anything or no man owes you anything, are you free to minister to him and to be ministered to by him? Obviously. And when you get into a lending situation, especially with another believer, it's an extremely dangerous situation. I think you throw up a wall. Any of you that ever borrowed money know the humiliation of borrowing money. And when you get it between Christians or between family members, you've thrown up a wall that is a very, very difficult wall to penetrate. And the Bible says, owe no man anything except love. And so if debt's going to create a problem, don't do it. Proverbs 22, verse 7, the borrower becomes the lender's slave. I've already mentioned that several times. And again, anybody that's ever borrowed money knows the truth to that scripture. Isaiah 55, verse 8 and 9, in summary says, God's ways are not my ways. And it comes back to this issue of God may want to do something in a different way. And debt, many times, denies God the opportunity to work. Now, from a financial standpoint, how much money does the bank make on that $2,000 interest per year? Well, if they lend it out at, let's say, 16%, and they continue to do that, they make $2,360,000. I used to own a couple banks, and I always was convinced that banking was idiot-proof. Because you buy low and you sell high. You buy the deposits at no cost, checking accounts and low-cost savings, and you lend it out at 12, 14, 14, 15%. That's buy low and sell high. And bankers have understood that for centuries. They don't have to get rich quick. How do they get rich? They get rich slow. That's exactly right. The only problem is that they make bad loans sometimes. But you get rich slow rather than get rich quick. Compounding works against you. Those of you that have borrowed money for a home mortgage know that if you borrow money on a 30-year mortgage at 10%, you pay back three times the purchase price of the home. Compounding is working against you rather than for you. So that's the economic reason. Getting in debt is a lot easier than getting out of debt. We've already talked about that. One of the reasons that getting in debt is so easy, or getting out is so difficult on the other side, is that if you decide to get out, the first thing that you have to do is stop overspending. Typically, it takes a dramatic decrease in living expenses, lifestyle in other words, in order to get out of debt. Because you've got to stop the overspending, and then you got to start paying it back. And you know what? Debt is always paid back with after-tax dollars. So if you're in a 50% bracket and have $20,000 a year in debt payments, you have to earn $40,000 to have enough to pay the $20,000. There's no way around that. Debt is always paid back with after-tax dollars. Living expenses are always done with after-tax dollars. Taxes are paid with after-tax dollars. All three of those, you have to earn enough to have the money left to pay them. Giving is the only one of these that gives you some tax benefit, and in some cases, investments do too. But long-term, you can only accumulate with after-tax dollars. The government's not dumb. They do not allow you to accumulate for free. They are going to get their money at some point in taxes. There is no such thing as tax avoidance. There's tax deferral, but never tax avoidance. And that's a principle a lot of people forget. They think, you know, you eat it up right here, forgetting that you got to pay it back with after-tax dollars. So you postpone the penalty. Thirdly, debt always mortgages the future. And we've already illustrated that in many ways. But here's the trick. The deception, the better word. The deception is that debt will sentence me to a lower standard of living in the future. Now, our advertisers seem to say, enjoy it today. You know, while you're paying for it, enjoy it. Raise your standard of living. But what has it done? It's obligated the future to be paid back with after-tax dollars. Therefore, you have sentenced yourself whenever you take on debt to a lower standard of living in the future. And then lastly, debt always robs your freedom of choice. Robs you of your freedom of choice. The banker has first cut out of the pie, always, when you have debt. Now let's stop at this point and ask if there are any questions in the debt area before we go on. I define debt as any money owed, to keep it simple. Some Christian authors define debt as the inability to repay. But to me, that's bankruptcy. That's bondage and bankruptcy. So for simplicity purposes, I like to look at it as any money owed. Now, when you put collateral on debt, all you've done is that you have got a guaranteed way to repay. Let me give you two economic rules to always follow in taking on debt. If you will follow these two rules in taking on debt, you will almost always avoid a problem. Number one, the cost to borrow must be less than the return. whether it's appreciation or yield or whatever it is, the cost to borrow must be less than the return, always. Okay, a home traditionally has fallen into that category. If I borrow money at 10% and my home appreciates at 12%, and with leverage working on that, I've typically had a higher return than what it's cost me. That's rule number one. And rule number two is that I must have a guaranteed way of repayment. If I will always have a guaranteed way of repayment, which incidentally does not include keeping my job, that's not guaranteed. If I have a guaranteed way of repayment and I never borrow money except for the return being greater than the cost, you're going to make some very wise debt decisions. As a matter of fact, there are five kinds of debt. I've got fives and fours and threes. Huh? Like Gail, that's right. I have the gift of exhortation, and that's the way I just think in outline form. Okay, there are five kinds of debt. Okay? Repayment? Okay. If you borrowed money to buy a home and you realized here and here that if I can't pay it back, I'll walk away from the home. The debt, the home is the only collateral that is required and I'm willing to walk away from the home. That's right. That's right. And he didn't come against you personally. That's right. That's right. It's a guaranteed way to repay. The banker has agreed, or the lender has agreed, that I will take no more than the collateral. And you've said that collateral is set aside, and if I can't pay, he can have it. Now, remember 1 Timothy 5:8. A man is worse than an infidel that doesn't take care of his family. So be careful. And the person that, let's say, goes into the $500,000 home on a $25,000 a year income, assuming that his income is going to go up, he's presuming upon the future. That's right. That's right. Okay? Because I said that it was a sin to walk away from debt, but if the lender will take as repayment on the debt the collateral, then that's not a sin, and that is correct. That's what I'm saying. The lender has agreed ahead of time that that's how he'll get his repayment, and therefore it's a contractual agreement, and you paid him. Non-recourse. That's an important point. Non-recourse debt. Okay. Serious question for the Christian to get into that position. Now, what you might do, one way around that, I believe, for the Christian, would be instead of doing the 95% loan, he does a 50% or a 60% loan. He creates actual equity that he is almost guaranteed. I say they're almost guaranteed of having a sure way to repay that debt. But see, we fall into a trap in the whole home buying, in that that was the investment for a lot of people. They created a lot of wealth that way, but we had inflation and we had low interest rates, and lenders aren't dumb. They don't lend money that way very often. They got burned once, but you can't get it today. Now, we're coming back to it, and I'm wondering, well, are our lenders really dumb? I don't think so. Okay? Responsible way? The old-fashioned way. Save for it. Now, it may be that, why buy a new car? Let me give you a rule, okay? I'm going to tell you what's the cheapest car that you'll ever buy. If you want to know the cheapest car that you can ever buy. You want to know what it is? The one you're driving. You will never have a cheaper car than the one you're driving. Now, let me explain that. You know, I said that one time in a speech. A guy came up afterwards, gave me a big hug, and he said, "Man, I love you." And I said, "Why?" He said, "I just bought two Mercedes last week." Okay, the reason I say that the cheapest car that you'll ever drive is the one that you're driving is because of the opportunity cost of going to buy a new one, the debt cost of going to buy a new one, or even a new used one, or used new one, whatever, will never
be offset by the savings in gas mileage and lower maintenance cost. Because the older car, the Wall Street Journal did another study, and they found that the longer you drive a car, the cheaper it becomes to operate, which is just the opposite of what we've been told by Detroit. The reason for that is the opportunity cost and the financing cost. The maintenance costs go up, yes, but the insurance costs go down, the license costs go down, and the opportunity cost goes way down, and the financing cost... Somebody have a glass. Need to get a drink. So, in terms of buying a car, you always have to look at the one that I'm driving right now as being the least expensive. See, we've got ourselves into a trap of thinking that we need to buy a new car. From an economic standpoint, that's never ever, almost never ever, the best choice. Now, I will say almost because there may be some contingencies, such as if I have a handicapped child, to buy, the only way I may go is to be able to buy a van that has the facilities for that. And obviously, though, there are priorities that overweigh the financial. Question back here? How do you determine, let's come back to the diagram, where did that desire come from? Okay? What does the Bible say about desires? That says one thing. But what does it say about desires? I think it's Psalm 37, maybe verse 4. Some of you navigators, what's that say? Okay, God gives me the desires of my heart. So what I have to ask myself in that situation is, where does that desire come from? That's a lifestyle desire. And see, I have not precluded that from this. I have said that if God has given you the desire for a new car, and you can point to the fact that I know that I'm in God's will buying that new car, fine. Then to not buy it, you're out of His will. And I haven't precluded that. I wouldn't want to, because I wouldn't want to take away the sovereignty of God and how He works in people's lives. He may want you to have that new car to show you that it's worth nothing in terms of satisfaction. I don't know. I'm serious. Anybody that has driven off a new car off the lot, how long does that feeling of euphoria last? 2 weeks. Yeah, maybe that long. Gail? I do not think. The question is, what's the proper Christian lifestyle? It's not poverty, nor is it luxury. Nor is it in the middle. Nor is it over here. Nor is it over here. I believe, and it's one of the underlying tenets of everything that I've said, is God is dealing with you and with me as an individual, and He's using money as a tool and as a test. Okay? And so He's going to take me where I am and move me one step forward in terms of my faith. I don't think God really cares how much money I have. I don't think He really cares how I spend it. It is certainly not going to impoverish God when I buy a new car, or when I go into debt, or buy a new home, or anything else. God's not interested in the money. He owns a cattle on 1,000 hills. Several years ago, God really brought that principle home to me. It was because I have a family of 7. We were thinking of coming out here on vacation. Now, you talk about extravagance. On my income, that was extravagant to come out here and spend a week. But through a series of things and through praying about it, it became pretty obvious to me that God was giving me the permission to come out here, if you will. That was one of my lifestyle desires. And we spent the thousands of dollars it took to fly out here and spend the vacation, and I was right in the middle of God's will. And others would say that was extravagant. No, I was doing exactly what God wanted me to in order to accomplish some other things. We're going to take a cruise this summer. That's luxury. I'm going to be speaking, so we'll get part of it paid for, but I'm going to take my whole family. It's going to cost me several $1,000s to take my whole family on that cruise. Am I out of God's will? I don't believe so, because I believe I am doing something with His money.
And that is that I'm building some memories and some values into my kids and some experiences of allowing them to participate in my ministry that happens to cost money. I'm using his resources to accomplish his goals. But I couldn't say that unless I'm spending time with him and I know what he's saying to me. If I had one piece of financial advice to give to people, it would be a daily quiet time. Because apart from that, you can't know. This is an implicit statement of God's will. And unless you're spending time listening to him, you'll never know what his will is. Manifestation of our spiritual convictions. I believe that. Good point. God doesn't care about how much I have, but he does care how I use it. And I think there's validity, a lot of validity to that. He's going to hold me accountable for how I used his resources. I believe that. To that. Well, that's your one. The five kinds of debt. That was the question. You guys aren't going to let me off, are you? All right, let me tell you what the five kinds of debt are. The five kinds of debt are credit card debt, number one. Number two, what I would call consumer debt. Credit card debt. Consumer debt would be automobile debt, installment type debt. Credit card debt is instant, yeah. Consumer debt. Thirdly would be mortgage debt. Fourth would be business debt. And fifth would be investment debt. Those are the five kinds of debt. Now, let me overlay this and give you a matrix. I believe that there are four criteria. Okay? You have the economics. I gave you two rules. Remember that? The economic criteria. Do you have a guaranteed way to pay it back? And does your rate of return, is it greater than the cost? Those are the economic criteria. Okay, let's just look at that for a second. If I have credit card debt, do I have a guaranteed way to pay back? Might have. I mean, I could have money in the bank to pay back credit card debt. So that's not automatically eliminated. But is the rate of return on credit card debt greater than the cost? Never. Never. Because by the very nature of it, you spend credit card debt for clothes and furniture perhaps and vacations and things like that. So from an economic standpoint, you would never have credit card debt. Not even talking the spiritual. I'm saying straight economics, you're foolish to have debt, credit card debt. The best investment that you can make is to pay off that credit card debt. You get a guaranteed 18 to 21% return on your investment. And you free up cash flow also. What about using credit cards for convenience purposes? Is that a wise idea? If you pay it off in 30 days and never get the interest charge. Get a debit card. Well, you know what somebody is called? Among the credit card companies, if you pay your debt off every month, a deadbeat. That's right. Why? Sure. They want you to pay the interest. Now, you know, I paid off a credit card not long ago. I gave it to one of my daughters. She used it for some gasoline. I paid it all off. And I got a nice note from the credit card company. So you're a good customer, we appreciate you, and next month you don't have to pay that debt off. If you just want to pay $10 a month, that's fine. So I paid it all off again, got another letter from them. They said, you're paid ahead. Don't pay it off. You know, you don't owe any payments for the next 5 or 6 months. What do they want? Obviously they wanted my interest. The credit card companies have done studies, and they've shown that if you use credit cards, even if you pay them off every month, and never incur any interest cost, your spending will go up 34%. When you use them for convenience, you conveniently spend 34% more. Think about that. Why did Sears come out with the Discover card? It wasn't that we needed another credit card. No, they know, and their studies have shown, and they're consistently will show, any credit card will show, that when you add another credit card to the mix, the spending level goes up. People do not replace, they just have another line of credit that they can add to. Sears estimates that with their credit card, Discover card, spending will go up $35 billion just by the putting of that piece of plastic in somebody's hand, whether or not they pay it off every month. Now, they also know that they won't pay it off every month, and consequently, they'll earn 21% interest, and 21% interest on $35 billion can support a lot of overhead and a lot of bad debt. They're not dumb. So, if you want to reduce your spending by 34%, I challenge you to do something. When you get home this afternoon, or tomorrow rather, take your credit cards, put them on a cookie sheet, stick them in the oven, turn it up to 450 degrees, and remove the temptation, and you will have...